I'm going to call the Jobs and Economic Development Committee to order. And President Kiefer, I suspect you have done the minute, read the minutes?
Oh, absolutely.
All right.
Sure. I would move that the minutes be approved.
All right. All those in favor of approving the minutes as written, say aye.
Aye.
There we go. We're done there. We have a couple of agency overviews today. Well, one agency overview and then a presentation. We have the report of the... Okay. I'm not sure. I'm looking at the Jobs and Economic Development for the 29th, and we have just the IRRRB on there, but there will be a report from the Robotic Alley. So... just keep that in mind. So with that, welcome to the committee, Commissioner. It's good to have you back.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Great to be here.
I know we're so deeply involved in the IRRRB and everything that goes up there. Should be an interesting presentation.
Well, I will try to keep it interesting and brief, we'll see which one arrives first. Mr. Chair and members, it's a pleasure to be before you. My name is Tony Surge. I'm the commissioner of the IRRRB, which is the Iron Range Resources and Rehabilitation Board. Got a couple of slides if you want to look at a monitor to tell you a little bit about what we are and what we do. First and foremost, we're a state agency, but we're different than any other state agency in government. And for a couple of reasons. We're the only state agency that is headquartered in rural Minnesota. Our offices are up in Eveleth, which is about 3 hours north of here. So while you have easy access to every other state agency, I need a three-hour heads up if you ever need me, because I live on the range, and that's where we're located. We're also the only state agency, not just headquartered in rural Minnesota, we're the only state agency that only serves a portion of the state of Minnesota. And I would say that we're misunderstood and misplaced by being called a state agency. And let me talk a bit about that. So here is the area of Minnesota where we our service area is. It's up in the northeastern corner, and I'll zoom in a little closer for you. It's where mining has traditionally taken place. Our agency was established by a Republican governor, Harold Stassen, back in the 1940s, who saw the boom and bust of the mining industry, iron ore industry in particular, and said there should be an agency set up to make sure that we can smooth out the boom and bust of this part of the state. And so our service area is where mining has traditionally taken place. If you look in the lower left part of the screen, that's the Cuyuna Range, where they don't actually mine anymore, but where iron ore mining was prevalent for the first 100 years of mining. It goes across the Mesabi Range from Grand Rapids all the way through the Quad Cities of Virginia, Eveleth, and Gilbert, and Mountain Iron. And it goes up the Vermilion Range, where there's now the opportunity for non-ferrous mining, but they did do iron ore mining underground there historically as well. And so this is where mining has traditionally taken place. This is our service area. It's a little smaller geographically than the size of West Virginia. There's about 150,000 Minnesotans who live in this area. It's parts of 7 counties. It's 140 some communities, and it's 15 school districts. And actually the borders of us are the 15 school districts that encompass northeastern Minnesota. The other fact is we do not receive state tax dollars at our agency. They're all local taxes. Mining companies do not pay a property tax. They pay a production tax instead of a property tax, a local production tax. And so that money is collected by the Department of Revenue and then distributed back to these communities. And so that's really, in essence, why we're a state agency, is because the Department of Revenue collects the tax and then passes through and distributes it back out to the local communities. And this is the breakdown of the production tax. And all of this is written in the state law, actually in the tax bill, not in the jobs committee. But the production tax, for roughly half of it, is treated just like your property taxes on your homes or on your businesses. Property taxes fund local cities, county services, and school funding. And the production tax for half of it is treated the same. And then in state tax law, roughly another 15% is direct property tax relief to homeowners who homestead their property in our service area. And so roughly 66 or two-thirds of the funding goes out the door and is not impacted by our agency at all. Our agency does not get involved in that. That directly goes from the tax collected by the Department of Revenue back to the cities, the counties, the school districts, and then directly to homeowners. We receive roughly a fifth or 22% of the funding at our agency to do our mission. There's a mining rebate of roughly 11%. And let me just touch a bit on that rebate program. Back in the 1990s was a bust time in mining, and local general managers from the mines approached the legislature and said that they were looking for incentives to make sure that the mining companies, and all of them are owned outside of Minnesota, had a reason to reinvest in their taconite plants in Minnesota. And so they set up this rebate program where a certain percentage of the production tax is rebated back to the companies if they reinvest in Minnesota.
Just might interrupt.
Yes.
How do you track what they're reinvesting, and do they have to reinvest and then present you with the receipts before you rebate the 11%?
Mr. Chair and committee members, they have to come to us on the front end and put a proposal together. We have a board at the IRRRB. That's what the B is a board, and it's primarily made up of local legislators, and they are really the check and balance to the executive branch of government, in which I serve. And so the mining companies and any project that comes before us, whether we're, and I'll get into the details of the other projects, every project comes before our board in a public meeting and gets voted on. And so all the mining rebate projects come yearly to us. They present their proposal. It's voted on by the board. And if it passes, then they move forward with the project, Mr. Chair. Here's the mission of our agency. It's to promote and invest in business, community and workforce development for the betterment of northeastern Minnesota. Three legs of a different stool: business, community and workforce development. Those are the three areas we work on. So in the area of business development, this primarily we work with existing businesses or new businesses. We provide gap financing, low interest loans and others for businesses looking to expand in our region. And so we help out with manufacturing companies and others. What happens is a business either located in our region who wants to grow in our region will come to our agency. They'll have a certain amount of capital that they want to invest, whether it be in building, equipment, or otherwise. They'll go to a bank to try to get a loan, and then they'll come to us for some gap financing. That's generally what happens in these deals. And so we help out a variety of businesses, anything from call centers, as you see here, to manufacturers. One half of our funding, as per state statute, goes to public works infrastructure of our economic development dollars. And so we do sexy things like fix up sewer and wastewater projects, curb and gutter, and the like. It's almost like a mini capital investment bill every year. Communities in our region submit plans for infrastructure projects. And as I said before, mining companies don't pay local property tax. And so this is their investment in our public works and infrastructure in our communities. And so many times our communities will apply through the PFA and others, and you need a local match, we'll be a part of the local match. And I see, Mr. Chair, somebody may have a question or is thinking about questions, so I'll pause.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Sertich. Mm-hmm. Just a question. You talked about they don't pay any local property tax. Mm-hmm. The mining companies, do they pay the statewide business property tax?
Mr. Chair and Representative, I do not believe. What's that? Yes, they have a different tax. It's an occupation tax, and so they do not pay the statewide business property tax either. Yep. Thank you, Mr. Pagel. It's always good to have industry folks in the audience to whisper answers to me. Mr. Chair and members, so these are just a variety of some of the public works infrastructure projects we have funded in the past few years. The great news, it's really a win times three when we invest in public works infrastructure. It creates construction jobs. It helps our local communities, and we rank our public works projects, our highest priority are on those infrastructure projects that are going to lead to permanent job creation. And so that's the second win. And the third win is every dollar we invest is one less property tax dollar that a local citizen or business has to pay on that existing project. And so this is an important piece of what we do. And we have a demolition program where we knock down old housing stock. And for those of you, especially in rural Minnesota, know that that's a big concern in redevelopment, is making sure that you can knock down some of these old properties when they want to be knocked down. Let me just make that clear as well. The communities and the homeowners come to us with these requests, and then we can do redevelopment on old housing properties. Third leg of our stool is workforce development. This is something that is a growing concern and demand if you're working in the area of economic development. Georgetown University did a study a couple of years ago looking at the state of Minnesota, and it said by the year 2018, which is actually just around the corner, by the year 2018, 70% of the new jobs in Minnesota are going to require more than a high school degree. And this is something that we're coming to terms with in northeastern Minnesota, because back when my parents and went to school and my grandparents, and I'm a fourth-generation Iron Ranger, you could literally walk out of high school and walk into a mine and get a job where you could support your family. And those days are gone, and we know this in many industries. You need something more than a high school degree to be successful in this economy. And so we're focusing heavily on workforce development. We're providing partnerships between our local high schools, our colleges, to make sure that they're delivering the sort of education that's needed for the jobs of today and tomorrow. And so one of the great examples is, of those 15 school districts in our service area, they're working together with industry and with colleges to provide more of those, what they called when I went to school, shop classes, technical classes. These are some of the most expensive classes to run because they're very labor intensive, but then they also take a lot of equipment. And so our local colleges are bringing college credit technical education classes right into the high schools, and that's something that we're supporting. We've started a new engineering program in partnership with our local community colleges and actually Minnesota State Mankato to provide a four-year master's degree engineering right on the Iron Range without leaving. We don't have a four-year college north of Duluth or east of Bemidji, and so we're providing more of those four-year and beyond opportunities at our local community and technical colleges. The other great thing we're doing, we're working with, and this is Commissioner Caselius here, who's touring our high schools working together. We're trying to break down some of those silos. People are still a little bit upset about the basketball scores or the hockey scores from years gone by, but we're trying to break down those barriers and work amongst our school districts. And I know many of those rivalries exist all over the state, but they're very passionate and intense on the Iron Range. We do mineland reclamation. Part of the state statute is we have to work on mineland reclamation for pre-about 1982 mining. The DNR is actually responsible for reclamating land post mid-1980s. And so this is a great example of a mine pit. And so what happens is when they mine, and they now mine open pit mining, they dig a big hole, and then they put a bunch of the rocks in a pile. And there are different ways that you can leave the land. That doesn't look too beautiful to me, but this is what it looks like today when you reclimate the land. And actually, you're building lakes. And I know that Representative Ward knows a bit about that in his neck of the woods, because they've done a lot of reclamation down there, and they don't mine in his neck of the woods anymore. But we stock these old mine pits with fish, and they're great places to recreate. And so we do a lot of reclamation work at our agency as well.
You needed more lakes up there?
Yes.
Yes, absolutely.
Representative Metzen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to make an additional point on that. We can actually eat the trout and other fish out of these lakes, too, so they're not just lakes with fish, but we can, in fact...
What's the matter with eating the fish in my district?
That's your problem down here.
No, it's your problem, not mine. Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Representative Commissioner Sertich. Just a point on that. We not only created lakes up there in the mine pits, we have multi-use recreational opportunities mm-hmm. in that area. We just put, through some bonding and other monies available, we just established a worldwide renowned mountain biking trail, mm-hmm. which was viewed it as a job and economic development project, and it has turned out to be as such huge in our area. But we also, I mean, besides just the fishing that was talked about, there are multiple uses in those recreational areas up there that that we use in the reclamation of the old mines that I wanted to also draw attention to.
And members, if you've never gone mountain biking before and you try that one first, it's there's another word for it. It's called suicide. Representative Gunther.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I heard the other day that you're also sponsoring robotics up there. This is really nice. They told me that yesterday.
Oh, well, Mr. Chair and former Mr. Chair, my good friend, Representative Gunther, actually, there's going to be a different presentation on robotics that I have nothing to do with. But,
that's great.
But I'll dance if you tell me to, and we'll talk about robotics. But if somebody wants to come build robots on the range, we'll help them if it's going to create jobs.
By the way, you know, we worry about mercury in most of the lakes that we you have to eat the fish out of. We have to worry about iron and those lakes.
Mr. Chair and members, actually not. It's some of the cleanest water in the world, and there's a natural aquifer underneath most of them, and so it's crystal clear water. It's absolutely beautiful.
You'll take me fishing?
I will absolutely take you fishing, and if the statute of limitation is up right now, I used to swim in these pits all the time when I was a kid. When I was on the cross-country team, we'd run around for a while on old mine trails and jump in the water, and it's beautiful and gorgeous. Yeah.
Representative Fabian, you had a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner Sertich, you talked a little bit about reclamation and so forth. In the past 2 years, we've done some work here in the legislature with some permitting things for the magnetation and so forth. I know it's a little off topic, but can you give me a little update on how that's going?
Yes, Mr. Chair and Representative, through your good work in the legislature, the speeding up of the permitting has been extremely helpful. Magnetation is a great example. Because they're doing scram mining operations, it has a little less of an impact, and it's impacting old mining area. And so we were able to speed up permits for magnetation and others. And I shouldn't say we're not a regulatory agency, but my sister agencies in the PCA and DNR. And I just saw some statistics from their shop yesterday, and I believe they're somewhere around hitting 96% of permits being done in that 150 days. And my boss, Governor Dayton, has wanted to lessen that to 90 days to see if we can get a whole chunk of permits done in 90 days or less as well. And so I know that they're continually working on speeding up those timelines for permits.
And members, before we get too far into the questions, how much more do you need to finish up your presentation?
I probably need about 3 minutes to finish up the rest of my presentation.
Why don't you finish that, and then I've got Isaacson and Uglum. Uglum. And I think that's it. So
okay.
Why don't you finish your presentation? Oh, Norton, okay.
Okay, great. Mr. Chair and members, we also own Giants Ridge Golf and Ski as an agency, one of the three T's, Taconite Timber and Tourism. Tourism is a big factor for us, so there's two world-class golf courses and a ski hill. We actually contract out the operations of the golf courses to Troon Golf, which is a world-renowned operator of golf courses, but we own these facilities as tourist destinations. It's a 50-50 partnership. All of the on-site hotels and others are privately owned, but we own the public entities of the ski hills and the golf courses. We also are trying to help our local existing Main Street businesses. We launched this website called madeontherange.com, and so this is free advertising for any business who produces a good or service made in our service area. And so if you go to www.madeontherange.com, you can buy mukluks that are made in Ely. You can the local meat shops and auto services and the like are all listed here. And so if you're looking for a good Minnesota-made business, and Valentine's Day, gentlemen, is right around the corner, www.madeontherange.com, and you can find... I'm doing the hard sell here. I'm always selling for northeastern Minnesota. The good news about these local businesses, for every dollar that is invested in a local business, if you spend a dollar in a local Main Street business, 68 cents of that stays in your local economy, and so we try to promote our local businesses every chance we can get. We've also relaunched our website and our overall design. You know, people don't come to northeastern Minnesota because there's a bureaucracy called the IRRRB. They come to northeastern Minnesota because they like to recreate. They like the woods and the trees and the outdoors. And so on the left there, you see our old wordy, please come to northern Minnesota because we can tell you a lot of things. Here's our new relaunch. That's the reason people come to northern Minnesota. And so we are promoting our region and less about promoting our agency. But for a very long time, our agency, you only heard about us when we funded projects that did not work. And something I've said publicly in every meeting, whether I'm on the range or down here at the Capitol, is because we take risk, because we invest in businesses, you know, not every business succeeds. And so we're going to invest in a business in my time as commissioner, and that business is going to fail. Now, we try to minimize that. We do our due diligence. We look over their bank statements. We look over their business plans. But we, from time to time, invest in businesses that fail. And that's part of the risk about being in economic development. And we try to minimize that. But what we don't do is do a good enough job of telling our successes. And so I'm just going to show you a few slides on our successes. Here, just by dots first, and I'll give you the aggregate numbers in a minute. Here's our impact in our region just in the past 2 years. And by dot, these are the projects we've done. And so these are the workforce development projects that are primarily at our schools and our colleges. Here are all the community development projects. These are the infrastructure projects we've done. This is just in the past 2 years. And here are the businesses we've helped in the blue. And so if you look at the impact, just in the past 2 years, we have invested a little under $90 million in our region. It is leveraged almost $500 million of other funding. And it's created over 2,000 construction jobs and over 1,000 permanent jobs. And so this is the part of the story we don't tell all the time, and it's important to know that we are investing in businesses. And my goal as commissioner is to really invest in our local businesses, the idea of economic gardening. You know, we could take a bag of money and travel all over the world and say, come to northeastern Minnesota because we have some money to give you. And the problem with that sort of economic development strategy is when the economic incentive, when the money dries up, the business tends to leave. And so we've focused more of our efforts in trying to hit those singles and doubles instead of the home run and looking at our existing businesses that are already in our communities. These CEOs live in our towns, their kids go to our schools, they go to our church, they attend our churches, and they're a fabric of our community, and say, how can we help you grow? You know, I would rather grow instead of trying to find one business to bring 100 jobs to northeastern Minnesota. I try to get 50 businesses to grow 5 jobs each. And that has a better impact, I think, when you look at the boom and bust. And so we've tried to focus our effort, as you see by just the dots on the screen, helping out many communities and having a good economic impact for northeastern Minnesota. So there's my contact information. If you think of questions later, if you think of a business that could grow in our part of the state, or any questions you have of me, but I'm open to answer any questions you have of me right now.
Well, we have three people who have got a question, so I'll start with Representative Isaacson. Representative Ulam.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner.
I have to put that as a hard U.
Yeah, I know. I know. It's tough. Like I say, it's Norwegian, so don't hold it against me.
I'm Irish, so don't hold it against me.
Commissioner, in addition to the fishing, which I'm always happy to hear that it's good up there, you mentioned, you know, most of your funding or a lot of your funding is coming from the iron mines and things like that. Are you going to be able to participate in a revenue stream from the copper nickel guys and some of the new mineral stuff that's coming up there?
Yes, Mr. Chair and Representative, absolutely. Right now, the production tax is taxed on how much mineral they take out of the ground, and there is a similar tax being proposed for the non-ferrous mining as well, and so that would be an additional revenue stream to our agency. And it would be treated similarly, I think, formula-wise. You know, most of the money going back as property taxes go back to the local units of government and the schools. But because the value of the non-ferrous minerals are much better.
Could be big.
It's going to be taxed differently. You know, the tax on mines right now is a certain dollar per ton, and the value of copper, for example, or palladium or cobalt, they're going to take a 5-gallon bucket out that's going to be the same value as a train car of taconite. Yeah. And so the formula will look a little different, but yes, that'll be a revenue stream to our agency.
Mr. Chair, I have one other question.
Yes, sir.
You showed a number of the projects that you've done, in northern Minnesota, particularly in Grand Rapids and Cook, the old potlatch mills. Mm-hmm. Of course, the market didn't favor those guys. I used to travel up that way and call on those people. But I noticed there's a big that facility in Cook is being reused now, and I don't know about Rapids, but what have you been able to do for that?
Mr. Chair and Representative, we are working with the local economic development authority in Grand Rapids in particular, and working with Cook as well to advertise those buildings and try to bring in new ventures. And they're looking at other bioproducts and other ways to repurpose some of those facilities and that have been shut down in wood products and value add in wood products. And so we're helping in the marketing of that, and we've put some money into infrastructure work in some of those sites. My biggest concern in some of those facilities that have been shut down in the past is so often the building stays, but some of the equipment gets sold off in bits and pieces, and it's not as attractive. And so we're working right now with a whole host of economic development partners to really look at those closed down facilities and try to get them back online with some new business.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Albright. Any other questions today?
I have a question.
All right. Well, okay, you've had a couple, so.
Oh, he was before. Oh, okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You touched briefly that the board is made of legislators. Is that all the board's made out of, is legislators?
Mr. Chair and Representative, currently there are 13, it's a 13-member board with 10 legislators and three that are appointed. One's appointed non-legislators, and one's appointed by the Speaker of the House, one's appointed by the Senate leadership, and one's appointed by the governor. Interestingly enough, right now, as state law stands, we cannot... We don't have the right authority to appoint our board, and it's because of population loss in rural Minnesota, demographic changes. After the last census, we cannot comply with state law, and so I believe range legislators are going to be bringing forward a bill pretty soon to address this issue, because in state law right now it says that the majority of our board has to be appointed by legislators who have 50% of their legislative district in our service area. And that's a whole long way of saying, if you represent our service area, you sit on our board. Mm-hmm. And right now, we cannot comply with the statutes after redistricting. And so I think range legislators are looking at how to address that. And so I'm assuming that they will be before this committee in short order with an idea or solution. And so the majority of the board, the vast majority of the board, are legislators. And then there's three other appointments.
Just a quick follow-up.
Go ahead.
Okay, so if there is going to be a kind of new language to make up the board, will there be any talk about making sure it's a bipartisan board or anything like that?
Mr. Chair and Representative, that's a question best left to the legislative branch of government, which I no longer serve in. But what I can tell you is, at least my personal opinion as somebody who lives on the Iron Range, I care less about politics in my job, and I care more about, you know, I'm parochial, and that's the part of my job. I care about northeastern Minnesota, and so my first desire is those legislators who are accountable to the citizens serve on the board. Okay. And that's at least personally my biggest concern about who sits on the board.
Okay, and I just have one more follow-up. It's kind of related. You mentioned the population change, and you also mentioned about the demand for jobs in higher education and mm-hmm. that kind of thing. And are you experiencing any kind of like brain drain up there? Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mr. Chair and Representative, I experience brain drain every day myself, in all seriousness, it is a challenge. It's a rural challenge, and it's a challenge in other parts of where your best and brightest go away to college, and they don't come back. Mm-hmm. And so that is something that we need to address, and it's multifaceted. They need a job to come back, but they also need strong schools, a good education system. They need a good stable home and housing stock. They need health care available. You know, and rural Minnesota and the Iron Range in particular isn't for everybody, and we've got to know and understand and come to grips with that too. You know, these are the folks that want to live minutes away from their cabins and hours away from the Mall of America, and they like that ratio, and that's okay, and that's a certain breed of people who like to go out their back door and hunt and fish and recreate and do all the rest. And so we're also trying to not attract the wrong businesses. I mean, it doesn't make sense for some businesses to locate in northeastern Minnesota, but for others it does. And so we're focused on that.
Thank you.
Commissioner Sertich, you guys up there all have that, the way the name ends throws me off a little bit.
I've been called worse.
You know, your brain drain, you know, I can name 20 families that from the range that are living in my district, so I'm planning on being appointed to the IRRRC someday.
There you go.
I have two more questions, and then we're going to move on to the robotics report. Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, I'm not sure who the voice was that came over your shoulder about the occupation tax. Mm-hmm. Could we get a little information on that at some point?
Mr. Chair and members, I will make sure that there's a briefing, and it's probably going to come from the Department of Revenue, but I'll make sure that it gets forwarded to everybody on this committee.
Thank you.
And then I have one other, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Fabian.
Thank you. You talked a little bit about expansion and growth and so forth. What do you see, what do you see as the major roadblocks to growth and expansion, particularly in the mining industry?
Mr. Chair and members, and we don't do a lot of work. I mean, we get funded from the mining industry, but and we do peripherally some work with attracting mining jobs. The biggest concern day in and day out is twofold. It's demand for the product, and so we're really looking at what China and India are doing for need of materials infrastructure work. And then the second piece is workforce development. It's no different than any other industry. It's that challenge of the baby boomers going away, and who are going to fill those jobs, and what sort of skill sets do they need? So workforce development is a major challenge. today, what's asked of it's mining is a really high-tech industry, and I just offer anybody who wants to come tour a mine. If you haven't done it before, it's absolutely fascinating. If you want to tour a mine, please give me a holler. I'll work with a local mine, and we'll have you walk through. It's all about computers and technology and GPS and all this planning, and it's still very labor-intensive, but you need different skills to be in mining today, and so workforce development is a huge challenge.
Would that be a tour on one of those 30 below zero days? Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Kiefer's question kind of spurred a question with me, Representative Sertich, Commissioner Sertich, sorry. You know, that I have asked for years, being a Proctor boy, mm-hmm. you know, I looked at the map and I could see where, you know, the geographical location, you know, never had included my hometown of Proctor as part of the IRRRB, even though Proctor moves the ore significantly to, you know, for all the range, for all of us or whatever. Mm-hmm. But, you know, tell me just real quickly, what determined what was in and what was out, mm-hmm. Based on criteria?
Sure. Mr. Chair and members, the legislature decides. I mean, we're a creature of the legislature, and so back many, many years ago, long before I was around and probably born, they decided which communities had the greatest mining had the greatest impact on those communities, and so they drew those school districts as the ones. And so it was a legislative decision years and years and years ago.
So, Representative Ward, I think you have your work cut out for you in the future as
I
we try to read
legislation coming forward, Mr. Chair, that
or an amendment at the appropriate time.
And Mr. Chair, just one wrap up, because you may I love to come to the Capitol and present in front of committees anytime you want me, but just to kind of bookend my conversation here, as a reminder, you're getting an overview of the agency, but the legislature actually does not decide our spending. It's that local board decides our spending, and so while you may see some numbers in a budget book, because Department of Revenue tracks our figures, the legislature does not fund our agency, make funding decisions on our agency, and so you will not see me again as far as budgets go, but I'm available anytime to answer any questions. All of our money is local tax dollars. It's not general fund. It's not state tax dollars, and so those decisions get made up north. But if you're ever interested in how we do it, I've a strong desire of mine and goal of mine is to become a more transparent agency. So if you log into our website, www.irrb.org, we are putting online all of the funding that we've done. We've gone back 10 years now, and we're going to continue to go back. Our agency is 72 years old. We've actually been around longer than agencies like the PCA and DEED and others. And we have a pole barn behind our agency where all of these documents are kept. And we're going to go back 72 years and show you where we've invested all of our funding. But you go to our website, you can see where every project, where it was funded, how much leverage, how many jobs. We audit our jobs every year with businesses that have a loan with us. And then you can also watch our board meetings as well. They're all archived and online. And so if folks are interested ever in the accountability and how it all works, feel free to log onto our website and you can see it all.
Well, I guess we have one final question from Representative Gunter.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner Sertich. It kind of rings a bell to Proctor and International Falls, mm-hmm. although they aren't technically in the taconite area. Mm-hmm. They do get paid money through some certain process. Because of their International Falls supplies workers to the range, and Proctor is the gateway to getting the ore out of here. What is that funding for, and isn't it still there?
Mr. Chair and members, there's actually a small amount of pass-through. Coochin County and Carlton County do get a small amount of money. When I put that pie chart up, there's that little 1% of other. And those two counties get a small amount of the production tax to do economic development in their counties, and so that is passed through. We don't have anything to do with that, and so yes, Representative Ward is getting a good deal already. He just doesn't know it.
not good enough for Representative Ward. Okay, the last question, because I do want to get to this robotic report, Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Sertich, in one of your first slides, you identified the pie chart, mm-hmm. But it didn't denote the size of the funding that you're offering on a yearly basis in a dollar value. Mm-hmm. Could you speak to that a little bit?
Sure, Mr. Chair and Representative, it varies from year to year, and here's a difference of other agencies and us as well. We budget on an annual basis and not a biannual basis like others in state government. Reason being is the production tax is very volatile, and not to bore you too much with it. So we were going along pretty well in the mining industry, and they were producing a little under 40 million tons per year. And then 2009 hit, and it went from 40 million tons per year down to about 17 million tons in 1 year. Now, the beauty of the production tax, though, in how it's set up, based on a three-year average of production, and so that cushions the blow of going from 40 million tons 1 year and getting that revenue down to 17 million tons. Mm-hmm. And so it's based on this three-year average. The good news is it cushions those blows. The bad news is that anchor year is still on the books. It's still affecting our budget. My first year as commissioner, we had to cut. We had a 33% drop in our revenue at our agency. Had to cut a lot of operations. So the general dollar amount for a yearly budget varies based on production. Just last year, our budget was $38 million.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah.
And we have, just for point of information, we roughly have 56 employees as well. So we're a pretty small shop.
Thank you.
Mr. Sertich, thank you. I do understand that if we could figure out a way that you didn't have to come down here as often, you would be happier, and we wouldn't be unhappy with that.
but I'm available anytime, just a 3-hour heads up. But thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I appreciate it.
Members, I have this bad habit of trying to do a lot of high technology and a lot of gadgets and gadgets in this committee, the committee I chaired before. I'm pretty interested in the... a number of years ago, we really had a big focus on medical device and high-tech devices. I'm trying to find new things to bring into our state because the more brain power we have, the better the economy, the better the quality of life. So I was made aware that a report's being done by I'm going to go Robotic Alley. I'm not sure, and I'm sure I'll get the exact name of who did the report here when our next presenter comes up, but this is really a report on how robots and robotics can affect the economy of the state of Minnesota. And hopefully it's looking forward a good number of years. I haven't read the report myself. I've kind of previewed and been to a couple of their events, so I have a little bit of an idea. And as soon as the computer gets up and running, we will start this presentation. You know, it's too bad Rukavina isn't here because he could say something about if it was printed on paper, it'd all be ready to go and we'd be into it.
There you go.
You know, technology is holding us up.
And Mr. Chair, we'd be supporting International Falls even more, their paper mill.
I might have. You know, I don't really know.
There aren't any appointments as of right now because we can't meet the criterion to legally, in current statute, do those under the way it's structured. So we're going to be introducing some language very soon.
Representative Messa, are you telling me that Commissioner Sertich has no controls?
We're just... I better be careful here. We trust Commissioner Sertich and the governor's office to do their due diligence to make sure that what we're presenting to the rest of the members here will be a very good solution.
Almost a good save.
We covered pretty well.
Mr. Bordine,
it rhymes with Marine with a B.
Did you want to say a few words before your computer? Oh, I think the computer is getting pretty close.
And Mr. Chairman, members, for the record, I want to clarify. Robotics Alley is an industry-led cluster initiative, and I serve as executive director.
I think you can sit down now.
Oh, sorry. Yeah. Thank you. Do I need a microphone?
Oh, the other way. There you go. There it is.
And
There you go.
Oh my God, Joe. No.
You know these. I'm gonna credit the Defense Alliance's Chip Langan with this one. So who's a sailor? His favorite
before
joke.
Before you go any further, could you identify yourself for the tape and then proceed, please?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, members, thank you very much for having me here. My name is Andrew Boreen, and I'm the Executive Director of Robotics Alley. I'm an executive with Recon Robotics, an Edina company that is the world leader in tactical micro-robots. And I'm also leading an effort to bring in AUVSI, Association of Unmanned Vehicle Systems, chapter here to the Twin Cities. I just wanted to clarify, Mr. Chairman, the report that's being done on this industry for its growth and its economic development prospects is being done by a former colleague and a friend of mine, Nina Fox, who is the CEO of something we call GRIP, or the Global Robotics Innovation Park. But if I could ask her to join me, I've asked that I give an overview of the industry briefly and the players, but Nina will have really some excellent answers for you and for the committee and her prospects on the data and the metrics of what this could mean for job growth.
There's a second chair there.
Thank you. good. So I think, Mr. Chairman, if it's acceptable, maybe I could give a brief overview. And then I think what we'll do is Nina's got some remarks prepared on her process and her project, and then we agree that we take some questions if you have them. So I think I explained who I am. Before I start, I just want to talk about kind of four broad assumptions that I hope I leave with you as the members of this committee. The first being that the robotics revolution is real and it's happening now. The second being the Twin Cities has the potential to be a player in this global industry as it grows if we decide to pull together and start bringing together a network of opportunities that can help us seize long-term high-paying jobs in this high-tech market sector. And then the third point being that public-private partnerships really will be vital to our success in this effort. And the good news is that this is a Minnesota strength. We have a long history of working together with government and private sector and industries and higher education to make things happen. And my message, and I know Nina will have more details on her project, my message is just that industry is here to help. There are companies, there are leading research institutions here in the state, and we're starting to build a network. And as you determine your path forward as the state's policymakers, we're here to help you in however we can. So a couple of talking points on the global industry. Just a couple of years ago, Bill Gates referred to robotics today as being somewhere near where the PC industry was in the late 70s. It was emerging. It was going to happen. People didn't know where would the geographic centers of excellence be. People didn't know which companies would be leading in it. You know, you couldn't have identified Dell or Apple or IBM or Google in 1979, but people knew that the industry was growing, and I think that's where this robotics space is. Just recently, Amazon purchased a robotics company called Kiva Systems for $775 million. Kiva makes robots that automate warehouses, and when you hear about Amazon talking about same-day delivery, a large piece of that strategy will include automation solutions. It was forecast in an international study, I think it was done by one of the Pacific nations, that globally this industry could create 1 million jobs globally by 2016. And that service robotics are now coming online in home healthcare and in personal, almost retail type price ranges, much like the car did in the early 20th century. Industrial robot sales were up 18% in 2011, so increased automation on assembly lines and high-tech manufacturing. And then in the unmanned air system space, it was estimated that $71 billion would be spent in the next 5 years. So globally, this is an emerging market space that will be very well established. And the other reason is because the White House advisor said so. we had Minnesota High Tech Association had an event with the president's advisor on robotics and advanced manufacturing over at the Humphrey School last year, and he helped lay out just exactly why the president values this. President Obama put forward a national robotics initiative in the last couple of years, and that continues to evolve as we determine how we can seize opportunities and establish some leadership in the future of that. Robotics is a technology that not only enables existing frameworks for market space. You know, it enhances life sciences. It enhances computer science. It enhances manufacturing. But it also creates end products. Recon Robotics, the company that I work for, is a perfect example. It creates, in essence, a throwable reconnaissance camera that's used by security, law enforcement, militaries around the world, and it saves lives. And it was a new product. It didn't exist, and now it does, in addition to the enabling that I mentioned. And it crosses in several sectors. It's going to hit medicine and life sciences. Certainly it will hit agriculture. It'll increase efficiencies. It'll increase outputs on agriculture. Security and defense, the applications are pretty obvious to most people. The industrial applications continue to grow, even in precision biosciences type manufacturing and research. And then, as I mentioned, personal service and retail robotics will come in. And on that note, here's a screenshot, I don't know if you can see it, of USA Today last November. And it talked about how robotics firms around the country were actually working on service robots, you know, laundry folding and general tasks. In Minnesota, I guess the Iron Range Board might want snowblower robots.
I want a snowblower robot.
Yeah.
Here's the IRRB.
Here's a picture of the map of the United States, and I think this has been a talking point I've been using for a couple of years, but if you ask the kind of collective knowledge or what's common wisdom of where are the centers of excellence in the industry, they would say Boston, where there's Massachusetts Institute of Technology, and it's a science center. They would say Pittsburgh, where Carnegie Mellon has been working on this for decades, and driverless cars are coming online. They certainly would say Silicon Valley, where there's a high deal of venture capital investment and angel growth in high-tech space. The challenge there is that it leaves a wide swath of the country unidentified. And we like to think that here we have a hockey rink in the state of hockey. But we like to think here at Center Ice that we have a lot of the resources that really put us ahead of other regions or other metropolitan areas. And I'll get a little bit into detail on that. If you look at our roughly six-state area here, this economy is almost the size of California's. It includes industrial nodes in systems design, manufacturing, distribution, unmanned airspace in North Dakota, and unmanned air systems. Growth is really booming. They don't just have back and reserve growth, they have unmanned air systems growth. The Robotics Research Institutes and Training. Recon Robotics is a company grew out of University of Minnesota Research Project. We have in Minnesota, the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities doing robotics research, education, and training. Certainly, as you look at Wisconsin, Illinois, North Dakota, neighboring states, they also have identified areas of expertise in the industry. And I think the other thing when we think about education, what it will mean in the growth of this market space, is not just the R&D done at the universities and the PhD level, but technical training done at community colleges. And really, to the point, yesterday we had some demonstrations at the Capitol Rotunda. We now in Minnesota have more high school robotics teams than there are varsity high school hockey teams. Not many states can say they have that kind of level of engagement by their youth in an emerging space, and those kids will grow up and start companies and create jobs, whether it's enabling or end products.
Mr. Yep. Green, if I might just say that having been there, for those who are interested at all, about half the team members were young women.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And then we did a study, and it was not highly formalized, but we did start trying to map the global industry. Where are the nodes? Where are the companies? And this was from Upstart Business Journal. This ran in every metropolitan market where they have one of these business journals dedicated to kind of venture capital and growth. And they said of over 1,300 robotics organizations mapped around the world so far, the Twin Cities area has by far one of the densest concentrations. So we get to start crafting this narrative ourselves and stake our claim to some world-leading excellence here. In terms of specifics, I know when Nina talks and what she talks about her research project, I think that they will put a much higher level of granularity and give more specifics as that process moves forward. But in the meantime, here's a list of some of the companies. And it's not just Recon Robotics. There's another one, PAR Systems, that has end products. PAR Systems is out in Shoreview. They manufactured and designed giant robotic systems that handle hazardous material in waste facilities. They built a giant robot that's going to help clean up the Chernobyl site because you don't want to put people into those kind of dangerous situations. And it's not just the end products, it's the components. Riverside, River Star, River Bend down in southern Minnesota manufactures components and pieces for robots that are sold all over the world. On the very large side, certainly 3M is moving into this space on the component side, on the material side. There are elements of Polaris that are moving into the space, and I add Thomson Reuters here. Thomson Reuters has been an integral piece of trying to pull together the fabric of this industry locally due to their commitment in science, technology, engineering, and math education, and due to their perception that they are a high-tech company and an innovation company. So you're going to see a nexus with data and robotics and intelligent systems. Here are some other of the players. I think it's worth noting there are law firms locally that want to develop expertise in robotics, not just the IP intellectual property law, but in the law and policy of robotics. When you have driverless cars on the roads, what happens to insurance liability? Those are good questions. What happens to privacy as UAS systems are increasingly deployed by law enforcement or private users? And that tells that story of who's involved. I mentioned the university academic and R&D spectrum from the research and development to create technologies that can be sold on through technical training and at the high school level. And then, as I mentioned, I want to introduce Nina Fox. This is an exciting opportunity for the state, and she started a company to develop a kind of a clubhouse to bring these things together. And that, you know, proximity will yield greater innovation. And bringing together the university research with commercial partners, with startups and entrepreneurial spirit and places for venture capitalists to come put ideas together and grow businesses is an opportunity that I think I'm better suited to defer to Nina on. The other piece of this is Association for Unmanned Vehicle Systems International and what we're trying to do to build a Twin Cities chapter. We hope this comes online this summer. That is the world's largest nonpartisan nonprofit group of the industry. And we hope that when we build this chapter, it can become one of the most active elements of that group. I mentioned President Obama's announcement of a National Robotics Initiative. It's in a fledgling form, and it's growing and evolving as to how that will work. But it brings together so many components from other industries and computer science and manufacturing that I think it's inevitable that will continue to grow. This is the obvious. Now, I want to close with a thought. Here in the West, particularly, we have this notion that robots are going to kind of end in this Terminator-style uprising. And they're going to take our jobs, and they're going to come kill us. And it's Armageddon because we're moving towards automated solutions. And so this is a kind of a cartoon about recruiting R2-D2 to join the Army. But I would challenge us to think outside of that box. This is actually a speaker at Robotics Alley in Edina last November. And Edina was, in fact, the center of the robotics industry universe for 8 hours in November. We had the head of the South Korean Robotics Agency. We had the head of the National Robotics Initiative from President Obama's National Science Foundation. We had world leaders from all elements of this industry assembled. But this woman is a Carnegie Mellon researcher who is studying the use of robots for stand-up comedy. And she developed an artificial intelligence algorithm, and her robot did a stand-up routine. So we dubbed her robot an honorary Minnesotan. But so I want to challenge us to think outside of the box on what this means, what this industry can do in long-term, high-paying job creation and improving human lives. And then I mentioned a bit about Robotics Alley, but we're here to help. It's an industry-led initiative. We're trying to, as I put it at a Humphrey School seminar on cluster development, we're trying to set this region on fire for robotics and what we could do. So we run around and are merry and throw out ideas and try to connect people. And I think that's a good opportunity to segue to Nina, who's been doing some research and developing this project that I think you'll all find of interest.
Thank you, Mr. Boreen. I do have one question that you can get back to me later on. I've been trying to find a testifier for unmanned vehicle testing bill, and I haven't been able to come up with a name just yet, so I'm sure later on you can present that one to me. Ms. Fox, if you would identify yourself for the record and please proceed.
Yes, sir. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, for the opportunity to speak with you today. My name is Nina Fox. As was mentioned, I'm the CEO of the Global Robotics Innovation Park, which we have affectionately nicknamed GRIP, which is a bit easier to get a handle on. And I guess I would like to start by giving you a sense of who I am and how I found myself at the helm of a robotics real estate project. I am a lawyer by training. I continue to practice law as a senior associate at Frederickson and Byron, and my background in law is doing land use, urban redevelopment, public-private partnerships, environmental law, and government contracting. Basically, what that means is when there are public and private parties and public and private money, I get involved and help make the deal happen, which means I'm very familiar with the technicalities and the nuances involved in helping public-private partnerships and alliances actually accomplish complex real estate development solutions. I've also for several years been an adjunct professor of law at the University of Minnesota teaching local economic development law. So in both of those roles, I've been the advisor in the room, and I have now opted to take the helm and try to be the person who's driving a project, the person who's trying to pull everything together based on what I've seen works and doesn't work. Another thing to note is that I'm in my second year as chair of the Citizens League Board of Directors. It's a 60-year-old nonprofit, nonpartisan, non-ideological, good government public policy organization in Minnesota. I'm also a lifelong Minnesotan and an alum from the University of Minnesota for undergrad and law school. And I think these are important things to consider because when someone brings you an idea, when someone champions something in an industry or something like this, that, you know, we're homegrown, Minnesota-educated professionals who believe in an opportunity here and who really see a way that the state and the region can come together on a really exciting economic development opportunity. So today I'm here to briefly introduce the GRIP vision, summarize our findings to date, and then give you a preview of some upcoming milestones. And I guess I'd like to start by saying that our company was launched about 10 months ago, so we are young. We're in the concept planning phase, and the concept for GRIP grew out of a conversation between academics, industry leaders, and local economic development professionals at Robotics Alley 2 years ago. It was incubated by a local business and then taken over by me last March. So the vision for GRIP is, at the most basic level, a real estate development project that is a research park and business incubator for the robotics industry in the upper Midwest to be housed in Minnesota. As Andrew showed you on the map, we are centrally located and have a great deal of resources in the metro region and then across the state to really be a catalyst and a hub for this growing industry. I described GRIP as a mixed-use real estate development containing light industrial, office, and laboratory facilities for high-tech research, development, testing, and evaluation of robotic, automated, and intelligent systems, and then complemented by business incubation, classroom, and office space. So a true mixed-use development that can provide a place for all the participants in this robotics economy to come together and collaborate. And we really view this as a hub of a regional economy, a regional industry cluster. And so the vision for GRIP is to offer tenants common technologies, knowledge, and resources within the park. And I think it's important to note that this vision is not necessarily location specific. There's a great deal of efficiencies that can be accomplished through co-location, but by no means do we think that all the participants in the robotics economy need to move to the hub, which is most likely going to be in the metro area here. Other participants throughout the upper Midwest and throughout Minnesota will remain and thrive in other rural and urban communities, and it's incredibly important that they do so. We're talking about a true regional economic development opportunity. An example there would be DigiKey in Fergus Falls. They're a great resource for engineering and entrepreneurs nationally and even globally, and there's no reason for them to relocate. There's not going to be economies of scale in them coming to the metro area. Likewise, with certain kinds of manufacturing opportunities, southern Minnesota has a great deal of companies doing some really exciting things. So that's generally the GRIP vision. Mr. Chair, you referenced the study we're doing. We commissioned an economic impact study of the robotics industry in Minnesota today and the true opportunity and potential of that industry if we got organized as a region to really build this cluster. And whether and how a robotics park could serve to catalyze that economy. The economic impact study is nearly final, and we don't have the final report out yet, which is why, Mr. Chair, you haven't read it or seen it yet. But that's forthcoming in the coming weeks. But what I can tell you and share with you today is what we've found so far. We have confirmed that the Minnesota robotics economy is diverse. In the past 10 months, I've met with roughly 200 individuals representing 50 organizations that are part of the robotics economy in Minnesota, in addition to myriad others around the nation and around the globe. And as demonstrated yesterday at the Capitol, it includes a wide array of participants at all ages and in all sectors, academic, entrepreneurs, industry, established industries. So we have Recon Robotics and PAR Systems that Andrew talked about, global leaders in robotics. We have basic and applied research institutions like the University of Minnesota, their Center for Distributed Robotics. We've got the University of St. Thomas, which has been training students in advanced engineering degrees for about 25 years and have been expanding that to undergraduate engineering just for the past decade or so. And they have this incredibly compelling, nationally leading way of educating engineers, where every single class there's a lab component. So you learn about thermodynamics, you understand the equations, and then you put them to use and you actually build stuff. And so their undergraduate students actually developed technology that spun off into an independent company, a robotics company that was then picked up by Recon a couple years ago. And so there's a way to make sure that our students who are embracing this really exciting hands-on opportunity to build and really be generators of ideas can also be relevant, even as students, to the industry and the Minnesota economy. We also have workforce development and training in the robotics economy here in Minnesota. And, you know, I have to highlight MinSCU, the MinSCU system, as an incredibly important partner in this. There's a low barrier to entry to be a participant and even a leader in the robotics economy. A two-year degree in engineering to become an engineering technician or robotics technician is sufficient to get you started. If you know how to tinker, you know how to make stuff, you know how to use equipment in a lab and build stuff, you have an entree. This is a great opportunity to redefine the trades and the way that participants at all levels of education throughout our state can get involved in a coming economy. And worth mentioning is Minnesota State University Mankato. They have identified this kind of relative gap in education available for students interested in completing their bachelor's in engineering. The technical and community colleges around the state under the MinSCU system have a whole bunch of folks and have seen this real increase in interest for students in the technical engineering field. And yet I think there are only about 7 places you can actually get a bachelor's in engineering right now in Minnesota. Minnesota State University Mankato is working very hard to change that. And so they've been doing some really entrepreneurial and interesting things to bring the higher ed faculty to the community colleges and the technical colleges around the state. So the Itasca Community College is an example where they piloted a +2 program. So Mankato faculty go up there and they round out the education so folks can get their bachelor's in engineering without leaving their community. And they can do that doing hands-on kind of work and project-based learning for companies in that region, in that economy. And so it creates this kind of seamless transition from I'm going to learn a trade to I'm going to get my engineering degree, and I've already been working with this company, so I'm going to stay here. I don't have to go to the metro area. So it creates this really interesting opportunity to think about the really diffuse nature of the educational system here and the low barrier of entry to become a part of the robotics economy. Then, as Andrew mentioned, we've got well-established businesses, you know, Honeywell, 3M, Medtronic, UTC Aerospace, and young companies. I'm going to mention just 3, and part of the fun of having these conversations around the state is I'm finding all these young companies who are doing really exciting things and who are committed to staying in Minnesota if they can. And so one is NPC Robotics, not actually that young of a company, but a really interesting story. They're based in Mound. They do innovative electric and mechanical motion systems for military and commercial clients. So one product that they have is a robotic solution to allow heavy doors of MRAP vehicles, so the mine-resistant ambush-protected big vehicles that our military uses to protect our warfighters in the field, those doors are really heavy. And if you're on an incline and you want to open that door, there it was a solution or a problem that needed a solution for a really long time. And some makers in Mound said, you know, I don't even think there was an RFP for this. They just started playing in their shop and called some folks up and said, hey, we have a solution and we think you have a problem. And now they have really lucrative and really important intellectual property and technology, and they're saving lives. And I think they've got, 10, 12 employees out in Mound. I'm not even sure that any of them have their engineering degrees. They know how to make stuff, solve problems, and they've got that Minnesota can-do spirit, and the military loves it. Robot LLC, a brand new company in the agricultural space, they have created a robot for production agriculture that will help keep nitrogen on the farm, and it's going to maximize yields and save farmers money through in-season nitrogen using technology that allows a robot to go, it's R-O-W-B-O-T, so it goes down the rows, and actually do kind of very precision application of the nitrogen testing and then fertilizing as needed. And they're in Minnesota, and they want to stay here. And then we've got, on a different kind of area, we've got MRI Robotics. They're actually located at the University Enterprise Laboratories. They're back there in the garage. And they've got an MRI-guided breast biopsy device. So MRI technology, magnetic resonance imaging, has demonstrated a significant improvement in the detection of breast cancer, but it's a high-cost solution in a confined space, and they're coming up with a way to make this accessible. And they're doing that in Minnesota with technology that came out of the University of Minnesota. And there are emerging industries, so Stratasys, which you may be aware of, 3D printing, additive manufacturing, they're from Eden Prairie, and they're a global brand and a brand new emerging industry. And then we've got industry associations, the Minnesota Precision Manufacturing Association, the Minnesota High Tech Association, Robotics Alley is kind of a new, not necessarily officially an association, but certainly getting everyone organized here. We've confirmed that robotics is truly an embedded industry, and the companies I just talked about demonstrate that fact. And they're going to define Minnesota's legacy industries, our bioscience, mining, agriculture, retail, and industrial manufacturing, each of those industries are longstanding consumers of the robotics industry. So it's worth noting that, too. Global growth is going to be exponential. And the U.S. is currently playing catch-up after leading out of the gate in manufacturing and in the robotics arena. We abdicated the manufacturing sector to the rest of the world. And Minnesota, I mean, we have roots in manufacturing, and we have lost that too. And I want to say one thing about what I mean by robotics before I talk a little bit about manufacturing, because robotics is almost more of a marketing word here. And what we mean is robotic, automated, and intelligent systems and the hardware and software that support them. So this is a convergence of mechanical, electrical, and computer engineering. It is the convergence of hardware and software. So we're talking about sensors and a whole host of technology that you see in a smart hospital room, that you see in automated gantry cranes. So you've got this kind of wide array of applications. And so at the most fundamental level, robotics is about manufacturing. And we are, as an industry or a region, our roots are in making things. And we've gotten really good at designing things. We've always been good at designing things. And we have to start making things again. And so this opportunity is about bringing, inshoring, if you will, bringing that manufacturing industry back to the U.S. and to Minnesota. Andrew mentioned briefly the National Robotics Initiative, but I want to also highlight that President Obama 2 years ago launched the Advanced Manufacturing Partnership with the goal of making the U.S. a leader in manufacturing again, the goal of build it here, sell it everywhere. And he got together about 15 smart folks from industry and academia and asked them, what's the best way for federal government to make a difference, putting money toward that goal? And they came out with a variety of suggestions, the cornerstone of which is the National NNMI, The National Network of Manufacturing Institutes, President Obama has proposed putting $1 billion in federal money toward reinventing manufacturing, advanced manufacturing in the U.S. And there's a process going on right now to figure out where these institutes are going to be and around what technologies, and working with a team of folks in Minnesota to really figure out a way to bring one of these institutes to Minnesota. And it's an exciting opportunity. We can talk more about that if it's of interest. So one of the other things I've confirmed is that there's really broad interest in businesses, the academic sector, local economic development groups to really work in a collaborative way to support the robotics industry and to grow this economy in Minnesota. And so we're here today just to tell you what's going on in the industry and to answer any questions you might have and find out a way that this industry and our efforts to really build this economy can support the greater state priorities around economic development, because we do see this as an amazing place for a future of job growth and economic strength in decades to come. So thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Fox. Well, I'm going to take the prerogative of the chair and ask the first question. You know, you spoke to, what is your take on how do we help as a state promote or keep robotic companies in the state?
Mr. Chair, members, thank you for the question. And at this point, I would say generally the most important thing that I think you can do is support what's going on in industry. And a specific thing would be to support the academic institutions and the state, the administration here, in our effort to pursue federal funding around advanced manufacturing. There is a lot of money to be brought to this community if we can play that right. And so that's something where there isn't an ask now, but being organized and being dynamic and flexible to support the industry generally as more specific things come up will be really important.
And thank you, Nina. I will add to that. That President Kaler at the University of Minnesota made one of his top four initiatives, and it might have been, in fact, the first one he listed, robotics and sensors, basically smart systems design, as one of his top research initiatives. So I think when you look at the University of Minnesota as the state's higher education key platform, it would be well worth having conversations with his office and with their Office of Business Relations and Vice President of Research. And that will help lay the groundwork because of that the high need for good R&D programs that yield intellectual property that can create companies. And I think that's a really important relationship and something we can highlight as a strength for our region.
Well, I'll just follow up with this, that if I will tell you when we go talk to the university, they'll ask for a new building. They'll ask us to pay for it. And so I'll... As you come up with ideas, as you find out more information about the NNMI grant, I think it was, if you'd pass it along to the committee, either to the chair and I'll pass it out, or you could directly email it to all the members of the committee. Again, I try to keep Representative Gunther, when he chaired this committee, was pretty nonpartisan, and if he had a good idea, they could bring it forth. I'm going to try and do the same. So if somebody comes up with a good idea, bring it forth. So having said that, so thank you. Just pass that along when you get it. Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You mentioned DigiKey. First of all, DigiKey is in Thief River Falls, not Fergus Falls, but that's okay. I understand geography. And by the way, the materials handling system there, the robots, it's incredible. To go in there and see all the packages that they move through that place is amazing. That being said, Mr. Chair, to your point about the business, the robotic business here in the state of Minnesota,
Just an FYI, DigiKey recently signed a contract with a 100,000-square-foot facility in Fargo, North Dakota. So, you know, we need to attack kind of the whole thing in terms of the business climate in the state of Minnesota to make sure that we're taking steps to do that. And then the other thing I want to address in the state of Minnesota to make sure that we're taking steps to do that. And then the other thing I want to address, you talked about the UAS system at Northland Community and Technical College in Thief River Falls. They are on the cutting edge in their UAS programs. They're in the maintenance part. They have a partnership with Northland Grumman, one of the largest defense contractors in the world, for that matter, and also with UND's aerospace program. So if you want any information offline, I'd be happy to help you with that. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Albright?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to follow on what Chair Mahoney said, just in terms of, you know, you mentioned or referenced Ms. Fox about companies that are, you know, beyond incubation and they're, you know, kind of fledgling, and they'd like to stay if they can. You know, what makes them concerned? What impediments is it? Is it about the resource for funding? Is it about the resource for talent? Is it about the permitting process for, you know, what they're trying to do? Is it, you know, what are the impediments that they raise when you talk to them about that?
Mr. Chair,
Ms. Fox.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative, I've heard all of the above, and you know, part of the opportunity here and part of what the economic impact study is doing is kind of sizing up the barriers. One of the reasons that we aren't having a full welcoming environment is that the participants are siloed, and so to the extent that there's a regulatory climate that isn't conducive to businesses really staying and thriving, or there are opportunities to create economies of scale where students need internships and employers need folks that they can afford. I mean, there's a lot of coordination and collaboration that can be had just through conversations like what we're doing between Robotics Alley and GRIP and kind of just general development in the industry. But there certainly are aspects that touch on legislative priorities, and we can talk in more detail about that once we have the economic impact study out. But I've heard all of those.
Ms. Fox, when do you envision that that report coming out? A week or a month or 6 weeks? Or?
Mr. Chair, I would say within the next month.
Thank you. Representative Leiter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Fox, I'm curious about on GRIP. What kind of, you talked about it being a public-private partnership. What kind of venture capital are you looking at for, let's just say, that particular project, meaning the, I suppose it's buying of the land and the buildings and the equipment and everything else, and then the follow-on to that. What kind of private money's coming in?
Ms. Fox.
Mr. Chair, Representative. So as I mentioned, we're in the concept planning phase, which means that we have been funded by participants in the robotics industry to really vet this idea and say, is there a real industry here that has a true opportunity, and can building a place really serve to support that industry and serve as a catalyst? And so those are the questions we're answering right now. And we're getting very affirmative information on that. So what we're doing in developing the place, and we're actually, I didn't mention this, but we're wrapping up a very rigorous site selection process right now. And those were big parts of the questions that we needed to answer. So where is the best place to put it? What scale is the most effective, right? If you're talking about a $200 million giant project versus $20 million versus something very small and iterative, those are very different projects with very different funding requirements. And we are coming to conclusions around that very soon, and we will be having those announcements come out soon, which is a kind of a hedge because those are announcements that are coming out in the near term.
3M, Beacon Bluff site. Let's see, Representative Gunther, did you have a
Go ahead. Go ahead.
Representative Gunther.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Either one of you, Minnesota is going into a period of time when we are going to need some very good trained workers. And what part will robotics play in determining how successful we're going to be in getting that endeavor done, because in the districts around where I live, we're 4.1% unemployment right now. And Jackson County's even lower than that. So we have to do something to satisfy the thirst of employers if they're going to stay in Minnesota, not go to Fargo, to take care of those industries' needs. Is robotics going to be ready to play a significant role in doing that?
Yeah, and I think that ties in directly with the importance of looking at the higher education and secondary education as a spectrum, right? That we're not just focused on making PhDs that invent an algorithm that maps a room. We also need an entire second and third order set of workers that can be, you know, bachelor's, master's levels in engineering or robot science or computer science, big data. You also need technicians that can, you know, work a CNC machine. And so I think you need to look at this really as a network of institutions of higher education, community colleges, technical education. And when you look, I think also at the enthusiasm here, we have to be an outlier with the amount of high school participation in robotics. And it really is, it's my firm belief, and I think it's shared across the industry, this could be the mechanism by which America seizes leadership in STEM education again. We've lost some ground in calculus, and we've lost ground in computer science and some other areas, but robotics gets our kids excited. U.S. teams go to the world championships in this, and I think we have to take a look at what we're going to do for those kids and their jobs 10 and 15 years from now.
Representative Gunther, you had a follow-up?
Yeah, I just came to think as you mentioned that, is the enthusiasm because students can see a practical use of those things. I remember I went to calculus too, and I don't know what remember a thinking thing about it. I don't have Alzheimer's.
Yeah, Representative Leidinger.
Thank you.
Are you looking for a question? No. An answer?
Well, just kind of follow up. You know, to me, it seems like most of the robotic projects are really custom projects. How many, what's out there today in terms of the personal use robotics? There doesn't seem like there's a lot of useful stuff that's out there. I mean, I could be wrong. If you could talk to that a little bit, and then what do you envision? Are these items going to be sold on the internet through Sears or, you know,
wherever we can collect samples?
Or wherever. That's right. Wherever.
Mr. Boreen.
Yes. Thank you, Representative. Thanks, Mr. Chair. I think that's the question of the emerging global market, yeah. Right? And I think that this is what I tried to refer to, and I could expand on it as the PC analogy.
You've had about 2 minutes to expand on it.
Yeah, I'll be brief. The two other markets I might look at historically are jet engines. Jet engines started off as, you know, one consumer was the Pentagon. Within a decade to 15 years, 80-some percent of the jet engine research development, it was commercial flight, and it became a civilian technology. The Internet came out of DARPA back when it was DARPANET. Who could have foreseen that I would have Facebook on my iPhone and I'd have my kids on iPad FaceTiming me from school? You know, so I think you ask a really good question, but I can't tell you what the iPad of robotics is, because if I knew that, I would ask my bosses at Recon Robotics to invest a whole bunch of money in it. So I'm not trying to duck it. I can't tell you what all of the diverse applications are. What I can tell you is we see it happening, and it's a real next industrial growth step for the world.
Members, it is now 2:00, or we had about a minute left. So there was a couple of questions left. So I'm going to ask the testifiers to stick around, and if you have a question for them, grab them. This is really over the next 10 to 20 years. This is where we will have to go for a variety of reasons, and I could take up a half an hour telling you about it. But thank you very much. Please pass along your report when it's finished. The meeting is adjourned.